Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Wednesday, February 12th. It's a beautiful morning here in Old Town Park City, but it is very cold. We've got some snow coming on the way. On the phone to talk to us more about that, I've got meteorologist Cedric Haynes with ABC4.
Good morning, Parker. Yeah, I'll tell you what, let's talk about cold. It is frigid out there this morning. Temperatures at or below zero in many spots, including in the Heber Valley over towards Park City as well. It is cold out there, folks. Wind chills are definitely below zero this morning, so you have got to bundle up. That's talking the heavy coats, the scarves, the gloves, the hats. Make sure you got those ears covered. It's going to be rough, and we're not going to warm up much today. In fact, as we go throughout today, we're expecting highs to climb only into about the low 20s for the Heber Valley. And looking at Park City, how about highs only in the teens as we go throughout this afternoon? So yeah, don't expect a lot of warm up as we go throughout the day, but there will be a little sunshine that'll try to sneak back out as we go throughout the day. So that should at least make it look a little better outside, but don't be fooled. Now tonight, we've got temperatures that are going to drop right back down to the single digits to around 0 degrees again. So it's going to be another very frigid night and a frigid start for our Thursday. But of course, that's not the big story on Thursday. The big story will be the incoming winter storm. We've got a winter storm watch that's in effect for the area here for the Wasatch Back, and that will go on starting Thursday morning and will continue through Saturday afternoon. And we're expecting heavy snow, especially up towards the higher elevations there in the Wasatch Back, where we're going to be expecting snow totals anywhere from between about, let's say, 6 to 8 inches around the Heber Valley to snow totals in that 8 to 14 inch range, possibly up to 18 inches there around the Park City area. So we've got a good bit of snow coming. That means we're going to be looking at some travel difficulties and things like that, some hazardous conditions for your Thursday evening and Friday morning commutes there. So again, a winter storm watch is in effect, will likely become a winter storm warning as we go throughout later today. Other than that, the snow will continue off and on from your Friday, Valentine's Day. Could see some rain mixing in the Heber Valley. And then as we go into your Friday night into Saturday, it will switch back all over to snow, and we'll see off and on snow showers throughout your Saturday as some slightly cool air begins to work its way back in. Again, a significant winter storm will cause some significant impacts heading into the weekend. I know it's a holiday weekend, so if you're traveling up and maybe thinking about traveling around the Wasatch Back, just keep in mind that there will be some significant travel impacts due to the heavy snow potential coming up over the next few days. The good news is Sunday dries out. We're in the mid-40s, but guess what? Another storm system arrives just in time for next Monday into Tuesday, so we're going to be talking about more wintry weather potentially for the mountains here as we go into that time frame. So the active weather pattern is here after a very quiet start to the season. But again, don't forget, winter storm watch in effect. Winter storm arrives starting late Thursday morning. Parker?
I think we're ready for it, Cedric. Right.
Hey, that's good to hear.
Yeah, have a good one.
You too. Thank you.
Now with an update from the Utah Avalanche Center, I've got Nikki on the line.
Good morning. So yesterday there were no new avalanches reported in the backcountry, but on Monday we saw two large unintentionally triggered slides. Both were close calls and both involved experienced skiers. So you can check out more information of those on our website. Today we've got two main problems. The first is going to be that buried persistent weak layer. So we've got two buried weak layers of faceted snow within the snowpack that continue to be triggered by skiers and riders. The upper weak layer is buried around 1 to 2 feet deep. This formed towards the end of January, beginning of February. And then the lower layer near the ground is that weak faceted snow that formed in November and December, has caused many large avalanches and is primarily being found in shallow, steep snowpack areas. So repeater slopes or slopes that have already avalanched continue to reload and continue to be an issue. Those could be anywhere 1 to 3 feet deep. Our second issue is the wind drifted snow. So winds picked up a little bit last night. We had a few inches of soft snow that'll be available for transport and continue to form shallow, both hard and soft slabs of wind drifted snow at upper elevations and particularly on northeast and south facing slopes. Outside the wind zone, you might still be able to find a little bit of sensitive new snow as well. Today, we're going to have a moderate avalanche danger on mid and upper elevations facing northwest to east. On these slopes, you may trigger an avalanche 1 to 3 feet deep and several hundred feet wide, failing on one of those persistent weak layers we talked about. While natural avalanches are unlikely today, human-triggered avalanches are possible, and that should not be taken lightly. And then the moderate danger also extends to many other steep slopes, where human-triggered avalanches remain possible due to both wind-drifted snow and the lingering new snow. The conditions are complex right now, and stability is variable. Pay attention when you're traveling in the backcountry and be prepared to adjust your plans.
All right, thanks, Nikki. Not seeing any crashes reported across the Wasatch Back this morning. However, I am seeing some slowdowns for cars coming into Park City on State Route 248 there. Just a little bit of traffic, but nothing too crazy. Well, coming up, we'll have two guests. Park City Board of Realtors Board President Maverick Bulger and MLS President Todd Anderson will share 2024's housing trends and what's expected this year. And then later on in the hour, Dakota Pacific CEO Mark Stansworth will join us. He'll have an update on where development stands for Kimball Junction. After today's show, stay tuned for the Mountain Life at 9. First, author Kay Smith Blum talks Tangles, her new historical fiction novel that exposes the troubling legacy of nuclear contamination in Washington and parallels some toxic episodes in Utah's own history. Then Renee Huang with Park City's Wild Women Tribe highlights the unique value and benefits of women-centric gatherings and their importance for women's well-being. Getting into some local news now, the Utah Supreme Court is expected to rule on the jury selection process for the Corey Richens murder trial. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports a decision could come this month.
While the state's highest court determines who qualifies to be a juror for the high-profile murder trial, Justice Diana Hagan says it was encouraging to see the prosecution and defense working together on the issue.
I just wanted to commend the parties on working together to find a solution that protected both of the parties' interests and also protected the important constitutional rights of the defendant.
Tuesday's attorneys representing the lawyers in the Richens case argued justices should overturn a third district presiding judge's order. They say they want in-person jury selection and jurors from both Summit and Salt Lake counties for the aggravated murder trial. Corey Richens is the Camas mother of three charged with killing her husband Eric Richens and going on to write a children's book about grieving him. She's pleaded not guilty to aggravated murder, attempted murder, and financial crimes. Local national and international media attention has prosecutors and defense attorneys worried about finding enough impartial jurors in Summit County alone. If they get to cast a wider net, that could set a new precedent for criminal cases around the state. Third District Court Judge Richard Mrazek will preside over Richens' trial. He says he's unaware of any other case seating jurors from more than one county in Utah's history. Supreme Court Justice Paige Peterson says expanding the jury pool is a great solution and reasonable request in this case.
The Constitution seems to allow it. My only question is whether these statutes prohibit you from doing it.
State jury selection laws talk about the county in the singular, which the trial attorneys have argued is interchangeable with the plural, but Peterson found a more specifically worded law that states prospective jurors shall be randomly selected from the county in which the trial will be held. The defense's appellate attorney, Freya Johnson, says the law does not ban exceptions. Even trickier was the issue of in-person jury selection, the focus of presiding Judge Laura Scott's November 26th order, affirming the 3rd District's pre-existing standing order. A standing order in place since September 23rd states jury selection will happen via video conferencing. Prosecution and defense attorneys have long argued that media attention on the Richens case is an extraordinary circumstance, which is what's needed to overcome that standing order.
I don't concede that. I actually don't think that this case is extraordinary. It's not ordinary, but it doesn't rise to the level of extraordinary.
That's the attorney representing presiding Judge Scott, Bryson King. He also worries about allowing any third district judge in Summit, Salt Lake, and Tooele counties to ignore the virtual selection order. He's concerned that could complicate and delay the process. And regardless, Justice Hagan says she doesn't know if exposing jurors to extreme media attention will help determine who's impartial or if it raises more privacy concerns.
I saw that concern reflected in the presiding judge's order as well, that, it would be better to ensure that the jury's privacy was protected, their safety was ensured, rather than trying to intentionally expose them to a circus-like atmosphere to see what their reaction was.
The trial attorneys asked the Utah Supreme Court for a ruling by February 21st, the next time they're scheduled to be at the Silver Summit Justice Center, to talk about jury questionnaires. Judge Mrazek aims to send questionnaires to 1,500 potential jurors in Summit and possibly Salt Lake counties on February 25th. After the first round of cuts, the rest will be interviewed in mid-April. Whether it's in person or online is up to the high court. Utah law states eight jurors plus alternates are required. Corey Richens' murder trial is scheduled to begin April 28th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
I'm now joined in studio by Park City Board of Realtors Board President Maverick Bulger and MLS President Todd Anderson. How's it going today, guys?
Great. Doing fantastic.
Good to be here.
Yeah. I guess to kick it off generally, I feel like the last time you guys were on, there's kind of talk that the housing market here was kind of returning to this normalization, you know, after the pandemic. Is that kind of the trajectory generally you still feel things are on?
I think we're getting there. We're still, inventory levels are still below pre-pandemic levels, and sales are moving toward that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's accurate, what Todd said. We're seeing a stabilization in some of the median pricing across segments. The party line has always been historically, we're hyper-segmented, so it's tough to draw big conclusions about the market at large. But even within segments, we're seeing that stabilizing effect, which makes sense, because historically, we were pretty far out of parity with sister markets in terms of values. And, now it's not uncommon. Common to see pricing, approaching that $2,000 a foot level that we saw in Sun Valley and Jackson and Aspen, places like that, and even values far in excess of that with some of our new condo development.
Mm-hmm. I guess to start breaking it down by some of those segments, maybe to start in Park City proper, are there any numbers you want to highlight just from the most recent quarterly report?
Yeah, as we get into, always break things, single family versus condominiums, single family, we've got a median sales price that's hanging around $4 million mm-hmm. in Park City proper.
And that's the highest in the Wasatch back?
Absolutely. There's always segments, there's always little pockets, and as Maverick mentioned, we get into submarkets and tiny little slivers of things that you have to kind of really take a hard look at to understand what the little market nuance is inside a small segment.
Yeah, what is the condo market like in Park City?
Condo's a little bit more stable. excuse me, we're looking at median price change that's hanging very stable, 0% change when we're looking at Q3 to Q4. So we're not seeing those big swings in pricing anymore. We were on sort of an endless climb for a while there. A little bit of a correction coming out of the core COVID period, but now a little bit more predictable. Where we're seeing big swings still is when we've got new developments coming on. Mm-hmm. So for instance, around the Jordanelle, when the Pioche Village condo products came in, it brought the median price down a fair amount, because those are generally priced around the $500,000 mark. And so it looked like there was a retraction in price, but it really was just a result of the product mix that was coming on.
Yeah, obviously there's a lot of excitement when Deer Valley made that East Village expansion announcement. Lifts are now spinning. Has there been any increased interest in just properties in that kind of East Village, Jordanelle area since that area opened?
Absolutely. Every time somebody gets out there and looks around and says, wow, we see it, and we get the phone calls, and there's, surprisingly less availability out there than everybody mm-hmm. thinks. I think everyone looks around and there's availability, but it's stuff that might be a 2027, 2028 delivery. Mm-hmm. So it's not a lot that's right there ready to go, and so that's having some impacts, but it'll kind of keep pushing that price forward, and people are making deposits on things and getting ready for what'll be a few years down the road.
Yeah.
Speaking with some of the developer reps for some of these new projects in the last week, they're overwhelmed by the response they're mm-hmm. getting on product that's not deliverable yet for several years, and at prices that are quite literally a multiple on a per square foot basis of anything that we've ever seen here before.
Yeah. What about looking just generally over at the Heber Valley? How does the health of that market look?
It's seen a lot of change. It's seen obviously huge growth on both the north and south ends of yeah. town. So the area is more toward the Provo area, getting some impacts there with a lot of new construction around the sawmill area, and then the whole northern end of town, everything this side of the Smiths is just exploding with a lot of inventory to come. Interestingly, it's you know, coming in at a price point that we don't see in Park City. So seeing single-family homes under $1 million in a brand-new category, you know, as we talk about Old Town and you know, the city limits being $4 million, mm-hmm. there's a lot of value there, and the East Village, you know, is having a huge impact on that as people look at how close that is.
Yeah, I would echo that. When you're looking at the River Valley Road corridor into Midway and what will ultimately become a very robust North Village area along Highway 40, the commute time starts to factor into people's purchase decisions. They're going, well, if I'm fighting through traffic from the north, you know, and headed to Deer Valley, or if I'm fighting from the south, maybe this is a better alternative, especially given the price dynamics. Might be able to get a deal and have a similar drive to the resort time.
Yeah, I think someone from the board previously had kind of said that essentially the starter homes for for sale in the Wasatch Back were kind of the Heber townhomes. Would you say that's probably still the case, just looking at the market in whole?
Absolutely. I mean, you can buy a brand new townhome in the $550,000 range. It'll get you, you know, a solid opportunity that just doesn't exist in the city limits, and that's part of our, you know, expansion, and we've always looked at Summit and Wasatch counties as being our target market, and it shows the nuances in between all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's underscored the land value premium that people are willing to pay inside the bubble, so to speak, being, you know, in the school district, close to all of the core amenities that town has to offer here. You know, we're seeing, you know, prices in some of our elite gated ski communities for lots with homes not yet built, mm-hmm. You know, zooming past $8 million, and Old Ranch Road, similarly, a really interesting effect where kind of the most affordable ground is in that, you know, $5 million-plus dollar category for a quality, you know, single-family estate lot. So we're seeing an impact from the ultra-wealth category that's more pronounced than in previous years.
Is there any reason why you think that is, or just any trends pushing that?
It's just lock-in effect. You know, we don't have that much left. People want to be closer than all of the other people to the best things, and you know, there are some people with extra deep pockets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely, it's got similarities as you look at most Mountain West towns. You know, we see that, and all of these are kind of bucking the national trends where you look at things and you know, read the news, it says inventories are up and sales are down. We're the exact opposite. You know, we were up 20% last year with inventory levels down 15%.
Yeah. Looking just broader, Summit County, whether that's the Basin, Camas, Colville, any trends that are pointing out to you there just in the last year looking ahead?
End of the year, we saw a little bit of cooling in some of the peripheral areas. You know, I don't think it's a bottom falling out type of situation, but the rate impact is not to be understated. People are really struggling to wrap their minds around paying a, you know, 7% mortgage or more when you know, recent memory was at much lower rates. That you know, you just don't feel like you can get quite as much if you're a standard borrower purchaser.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask just generally about the rate climate right now, because obviously, like you mentioned, it's very high. I know there's can be a lot of all cash purchases in Park City that maybe offsets that, but for the kind of entire Wasatch Back market, how is that high rate environment impacting things?
Definitely has, you know, more of an impact on those first time buyers, the move up buyers that are trying to change things that aren't in that ultra high net worth category. So we definitely see it having an impact. I think there is some lock-in effect, but I think you're seeing it kind of change. I think people are getting used to that. And it, there's always a time lag with that where it takes people a while to get to that idea that says, this is normal. I mean, obviously, as you look on mm-hmm. a historic context, you know, a 7% rate is not a bad number. It's just so different than what we were used to for a few years.
Yeah, totally. And I just wanted to ask, you know, obviously I'm sure it shifts all the time, but on average, like when you look at the entire inventory across the Wasatch Back, how much is new versus resale?
That's a great question. We have a lot of new stuff coming on.
Yeah, right now.
When we look at, I guess, what's selling quickest and what's garnering the highest premium on a price per square foot basis, the new polished inventory is, or recently remodeled, I'll include within that category, that is definitely, you know, taking the top spot. People that have more money than time are willing to pay for, you know, the ready-to-go stuff.
Yeah. Just listening to some national housing discussions, you know, there's been concerns over tariffs and, you know, immigration measures as it could restrict labor. And, you know, also there's the need to rebuild LA now and what that could do to the labor force. I know it's, we kind of have a unique market back here. Do we expect these kind of national impacts to affect us here in the housing market?
We definitely always do follow the national trends. There tended to be, for a while, some lag time in between ours and the rest of the country, but maybe not so much anymore. And I think there will be definite impacts as you look at that. But as I mentioned before, we kind of buck the trend in what's going on at the same time. So it's a yes and no and a wait and see.
Yeah, I think... circling back to that ultra wealth trend, I mean, there will be segments that keep building, I think, just because of, you know, ease of access to capital and insulation from traditional market forces. So we'll see a lot of big homes, I think, continue construction, even if we're not seeing, you know, the kind of median family in town taking on a remodel project. We did see, I felt a nice recovery out of the election cycle. I mean, we always get that breath hold when it's an election year. People seem to be making more purchase decisions now than they were over, you know, December and early January. So it's nice to see that. But I think it is a little bit of a question mark in some people's minds what effect, you know, lumber prices and things like that will have on supply and ultimate pricing.
Yeah. I wanted to mention this. It's kind of been the talk of the town lately with Sundance potentially leaving. You know, I spoke with a Wall Street Journal reporter a few months ago, and she had profiled some new homeowners that were snatching up properties around East Village and what, you know, just talking to them about what attracted them to the area. And she said a lot of them had mentioned Sundance and just kind of that allure of Park City. And I'm just curious from the realtor's perspective, I mean, is that something that you feel people are attracted to Park City because of? And is that something you guys talk about when you're trying to attract buyers?
I think you're always looking at the, you know, offerings that the town has, the things that drive people here, the things that they can look forward to, you know, and we've seen town push back on maybe having too many events. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's plenty of things that will fill in and plenty of opportunities that we're offering to our buyers that will keep them coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we remain vibrant in the arts and culture department, you know, with Kimball and all of our other resources. So I think what we will see is the people that struggle with traffic being very excited about it if the, you know, ultimately that becomes the case. You know, I think I've heard some chatter from folks about, well, you know, forever isn't forever, right? You know, if it goes somewhere else, it may yet come back if it's not a great landing wherever it goes. So I'm kind of waiting to see what happens.
Yeah. Moving on, you know, you guys have mentioned just some comparisons to sister communities, you know, similar ski towns, whether it's Sun Valley, Jackson, Aspen. When you look at how those housing markets are performing, what stands out to you about Park City? What's different? What's the same?
It's always been an accessibility story that we have that those areas don't, you know, and that goes back forever here, you know, pre-2002 Olympics, you know, it was what put this area on the map was its accessibility. As I look and we talk with, you know, potential buyers coming in that want that generational home, they can look and say, wherever the kids happen to go to school, wherever it is, it's easy to get here from anywhere in the country. And that's something we have that those other areas just don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've previously referred to it as the altitude premium, right? We've got the clean air, the clean water, the best access to the top of the recreation pyramid. I think as people are looking around at where they're going to plug into their vacation purchases, there's something really safe feeling about Park City. We've got this open space moat, so to speak, around town. Mm-hmm. And when we're looking at the jeopardy of federal lands in certain instances, we have a lot of private land that's programmed for recreation here. And that's a really safe bet, I think, as people are looking at where to plonk down.
Yeah. Well, lastly, I just wanted to ask about the legislative session. I know there's some bills about short-term rentals and maybe some other things. Is there any thing the Board of Realtors is involved in or maybe discussing or just watching?
The nightly rental stuff is definitely something that we've collaborated with the local land use jurisdictions on historically over the last few years. And I know, Summit County has got their eye on that particular bill. We certainly support responsible regulation. I think if people are all playing by the same rule set, it helps nightly rentals keep a good name in town. And they really are a component of the lifeblood of our transient rental market.
Yeah. Anything else you guys want to mention?
Just, reiterating how segmented our market is and how hard it is to, throw a blanket over everything and say this is the direction that you really need professional help in looking and understanding what's going on.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Parker.
Have a good one. We've been speaking with Park City Board of Realtors Board President Maverick Bulger and MLS President Todd Anderson about the latest housing trends. We'll be right back after these messages. Getting back into some news, the Park City High School girls and boys swim teams brought home state titles to end the season. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the girls dominated, winning by over 60 points.
The girls team last won state in 2018, and this is the first championship for the boys since 2017. Favored to win, the girls earned 288 points, beating Deseret Hills High School by more than 60 points. That hard-fought victory came with challenges. The Park City girls were disqualified in the first race, the 200 medley relay, for an illegal turn. Head coach Gaudi Sharma said the loss didn't shake the girls, who won the next two relays.
That DQ in the beginning was very rough. It just sets kind of an emotional tone going into the meet. And then we had some conversations about pulling our best swims off, and they did. And it really goes to show their resilience.
The Park City boys won with 264 points, edging out Murray High School by just 6 points. It was a redemption for Park City after the boys fell to Murray in the Region 10 meet. The state title was riding on the final event, the 400 free relay. Murray was leading by 6 points. Park City needed to clock the fastest relay to secure the 4A state title. Park City senior Keegan Elgee said the team wanted to break its school record, but decided not to risk disqualification with the championship on the line.
Our goal was to hopefully not tie, and we needed to take the win. So it was stressful, but we all stepped up.
Short of the record, but 6 seconds ahead of the others, Park City brought home another state championship. The boys did break one record Saturday, swimming the fastest 200 free relay in the school's history. LG was named 4A Swimmer of the Year, an honor Sharma says is well-deserved.
He works really hard. He made it to Junior Nationals this year. He's still looking at D1 schools to pick him up, and hopefully he can swim in college.
Named 4A Men's Team Coach of the Year, Sharma says it's thanks to community support and great teamwork. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And U.S. Alpine skiers Michaela Schifrin and Breezy Johnson finished at the top of the podium in the first team combined at the 2025 FIS World Championships. The competition involves one racer skiing a downhill run and another skiing the slalom. The team with the fastest combined time wins. Johnson, who took the world champion title in downhill on Saturday, finished her combined run in fourth place. Schifrin clocked the third fastest slalom run to bring the American team the gold. She dropped out of the individual giant slalom race at Worlds to compete in the team event. This is Schifrin's 15th World Championship medal and 8th World Champs gold. The victory is a full circle moment for the two skiers, who grew up racing together and were roommates at a junior race when they were 11. Three other U.S. teams also entered the team combined, including Park City ski racer Lauren Masuga and her teammate Paula Moltzen. Masuga, who recently earned her first World Championships medal in the Super G, finished the downhill in first place.
Moltzen finished the slalom course in 15th to land the duo just off the podium in 4th. The U.S. teams of Jacqueline Willis and Katie Hensian finished in 10th, and Lindsey Vonn and A.J. Hurt finished 16th overall. In a bill that would require app stores to verify the age of their customers passed the Utah Senate yesterday. Utah News Dispatch reports Senate Bill 142 would create the App Store Accountability Act, which links a minor's App Store account to a parent's account. It still needs approval from the House and a signature from Utah Governor Spencer Cox before it becomes law. However, the legislature and governor have been willing in recent years to enact laws giving parents greater control over their children's access to social media. The bill would require both Google and Apple's app stores to verify the age of anyone in Utah who opens an account. The bill's sponsor, Senator Todd Weiler, says in most cases, a credit card could be used as age verification. If a minor tries to open an account, Weiler's bill would direct the app store to tether the account to a parent's account. Parents would also have to agree to any terms and conditions associated with the app. If approved, the bill would take effect in May 2026. Nearly 3 months after the rest of the 2024 general election results were certified, the Wasatch County Council will make one final race official today. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details on that.
The council will certify Brad Ellert as the winner in the race for the midway seat on the Wasatch County School District Board of Education. He earned a little under 1,800 votes, or 38% of all votes cast in the race. His victory comes after a 4th District Court judge ruled Wasatch County Clerk Auditor Joey Granger followed the law when she disqualified his competitor. The other candidate, Tom Stone, failed to meet the last financial disclosure deadline ahead of the November 5th election. Prior to his disqualification November 14th, Stone was in the lead by about a 3% margin, with ballots left to count. The judge's decision meant ballots for Stone were not counted, and Ellert was sworn in as a school board member in January. Ellert says he's committed to being a voice for all district families.
You know, it's not the way that I would have wanted this to happen, but I'm excited to be here and to hopefully give a voice to those members in Midway and also any members of the community that feel they need to be heard.
He's gotten off to a running start with the school board, jumping into discussions about the district's ethics and bullying policies. He says he's ready to handle the district's challenges as well as its successes.
We have a great district and we have many things to be proud of. So my hope is to be able to continue building on the great things we already do as a district, but to bring to light any other elements that potentially could use work so that we can continue to be one of the best districts in the state of Utah.
The results of Ellert's race will be certified in the county administration building at 4 p.m. Wednesday. County Manager Dustin Graybaugh says the county was waiting for a written order from the judge before certifying the race, which accounts for the delay since the judge's decision in December. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
I'm now joined over the phone by Dakota Pacific CEO Mark Stansworth. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good morning.
Yeah, I just, you know, to kick off this conversation, just wanted to start with some background notes for our audience. I think they're pretty familiar with this project, but just for full transparency, the Summit County Council approved a 725-unit development in December with Dakota Pacific in a public-private partnership that included 165 county-owned affordable housing units. That was approved in a 4-to-1 vote, with Councilmember Roger Armstrong being the nay vote. And obviously, this property is located next to the Skull Candy Building out there by Kimball Junction, just off of State Route 224. And since the county's vote in December, Summit County residents have started a signature gathering campaign to put the development agreement on the 2025 ballot. They need just over 4,500 signatures before March 3rd. And since then, Mark, your firm, Dakota Pacific, has applied to incorporate a town or preliminary municipality. So I guess my first question to start is, what is Dakota Pacific's objective by incorporating?
The objective there is to explore options as a landowner. That obviously came on the heels of the referendum effort. Our intent all along has been to proceed under the development agreement that was agreed upon with the council. So that is simply an option we are evaluating. But our focus remains clearly on trying to educate the public about the benefits of the approved development agreement and continue down that path.
Yeah, and in your view, would incorporating allow you to supersede the development agreement?
Incorporation and the development agreement can't necessarily coexist, right? Incorporation's a different animal. But our intent is to continue to pursue the agreed terms of the development agreement. That is the project that we have been squarely focused on delivering, and that's what we're continuing to focus on.
Yeah, well, as you implied, you know, you're ever since the signature gathering campaign has begun, Dakota Pacific has kind of gone on offense recently. You've started a website to oppose the referendum. Are you door knocking as well?
We definitely have folks out in the community trying to help inform the public. You know, look, I think the referendum really kind of comes down to one of three things: the effort there by the petitioners. Number one, it's either kind of a misguided hope that by overturning the council decision, that'll somehow put an end to this project and it will just remain de facto open space. That's not true. You know, a second could be just a presumption that probably carries a fair degree of hubris that all of the thousands of collective hours invested by the elected officials, trained staff, hired experts over a five-year period somehow missed the mark, and that there's a better deal to be had. And I can say with confidence that that's not true. The third thing is just simple information and false assumptions, and that's really what we're trying to tackle. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, people, you know, tuning in for a meeting or two, but then jumping on social media, reading a few things, and just not quite connecting the dots on what this plan is and what it is not. So that's what we're trying to do, is really just help the public become informed about the truth of the project, point them to their council members, go have honest conversations with them. There's nothing that council members are trying to hide. It's all been out in the public domain, but I think it's a complicated project, and there's a lot of misinterpretation about what it is and what it is not.
Yeah, so you say Dakota Pacific wants to move forward with this Summit County DA that has benefits. Just so, I mean, in your view, what are the benefits to the project?
There are myriad benefits. It's always easy to start with traffic because that is the most sensitive component in the community, rightfully so. As we've said many times, we don't want a traffic problem here, too. It's not good for our project, even looking from a myopic perspective. So we've been very focused. I don't even know if many folks realize it. It was because of some of the efforts that we put over 3 years ago that UDOT's even studying fixes along 224 in the first place. So we're waiting over the next couple of months for UDOT to come back with a preferred alternative. We're leaning into that very heavily, side by side with the county. That's one of the things I hope people try to really understand with our county officials, is that it's not just, you know, bluffing and saying that we can help bring a solution to 224. It's real. And the reason that they should get comfort in that is because our project is intricately tied to the success of that improvement. In other words, if that project doesn't proceed and we don't hit the milestones outlined in the development agreement, our project doesn't proceed. So traffic improvement, you know, creating a regional fix, this is not something that our project is causing. This is something that exists today, but we're trying to bring a real solution, a solution that UDOT is looking out to 2050, not to 2030, 2032. They're looking out 30 years to say, how can we fundamentally change the traffic dynamics? So that's a big one. Number two, affordable housing. We're bringing 340 units of deed-restricted housing in a project of 725 units, plus you've got 165 units of affordable housing that the county is going to be delivering. That's over half of the entire project. I challenge anybody to find a project anywhere in the state, you know, anywhere in the region that delivers that type of ratio of affordable housing. So huge benefits on the affordable housing front. Senior care, we're pushing on senior care. There's a couple of things that I'd love to kind of clear up from some narratives out there from the opposition, one of them being around the senior care facility. The argument is, well, they don't really have to lean into that very hard because after a year, they can just pivot to 90 market rate units instead. what the fundamental miss in that is by doing that, if for whatever reason we cannot find an operator, which, by the way, that is our focus. We've been meeting with members of the community, Gray Ribbon Committee, to try to find senior care solutions. It's needed in Summit County. If for whatever reason we can't, we can build 90 units, but it comes at the expense of not being able to do senior care, and it goes against the 725 units. So we'd much rather have senior care plus 90 units rather than just 90 units. So senior care, affordability, traffic, great public spaces. We're bringing in collaboration with the county some great public spaces, opportunities to have a real gathering areas for the community. So I'll kind of tailor it at that point. There's many benefits. We tried to outline some of those in our websites and in the materials that we're sharing with the public.
There's been some questions as to why Dakota Pacific hasn't signed the development agreement with the county. Is there a time limit when that needs to be done?
Yeah, great question. We've definitely heard the speculation around that, a lot of kind of conspiracy theory. Simple reason is it's a contract, right? Contracts require both parties to be in a position to execute them. Right now, the county's ability to enter into that contract is being challenged. So the parties are not yet in a position to execute. I assure you, if not for the referendum, the contract would have been fully executed, and we'd be spending our energies working with state leadership and UDOT on SR-224 improvements. So it's simply a matter of mechanics.
I did want to bring up just some points from the referendum sponsors to allow you to respond. So they have stated that Dakota Pacific is not outside of what of 100 units that are deed restricted at 100 to 120 AMI, that Dakota Pacific is not paying for any affordable housing outside of those units. So is Dakota Pacific paying for the 240 units at 80% or less
of AMI? Of course we are. How else would those be delivered? So 240 units are deed restricted according to HUD and county guidelines. They mentioned on their radio show last week that somehow we could manipulate the AMI levels. That's fundamentally false. Those are all stipulated very clearly in the development agreement. Those 240 units are long-term deed restricted between 30 and 80% of AMI. We're delivering those, A, because we're subsidizing the land value. We could get much more in market rate land value for those units. Plus, we will be building, delivering, and operating those units. So I'm not sure where that narrative came from, but it's just not correct.
Mm-hmm. And then you've agreed, from my understanding, to split the cost 50-50 with the county, but your contributions are capped at $4 million. So just how can that truly be 50-50?
Great question. Another point of clarification here. It's $3.75 million. That cap was instilled basically as an offering by the developer to enhance some of the things that the county wants to do in some of the public open spaces that would be jointly developed under this public-private partnership. So it was an economic incentive having nothing to do, as they mentioned on the radio show last week, has nothing to do with schools. It's not intended to be used to build a school. Impact fees, property taxes, things that will be millions of dollars levied against this project. That addresses school, fire, police, those kind of impacts. The 3.75 at a 50-50 ratio is simply saying, here's what we can offer to you. We hope we can develop it at an economic level that becomes 50%, but some of those things are purely out of our control. And if the county wants to do a bunch of embellishments, enhancements, and all those kind of things, we're saying, here's what we can offer as an additional incentive to the county. So I think that they're wrongly tied to it's supposed to be the end-all be-all to deliver every benefit. It's a fund, it's a pool of money to be used alongside the county.
Yeah, and just generally for the project, does Dakota Pacific have an overall cost estimate?
No, it's a very complicated project, and those are things that are not very beneficial to discuss in these types of forums. There will be significant investment in this project over a long period of time.
Yeah, and I also just going back to that 3.75 number, is Dakota Pacific pursuing to form a housing and transit reinvestment zone, that being a state kind of economic reinvestment tool? And if so, can the money from that go towards that 3.75, you know, number?
Important to understand that the county is the initiator of an application for an HDRZ, not the developer. Mm-hmm. We would be a cooperating party in that effort. We think it is absolutely a tool that the county should use, and we've tried to tee this project and the development agreement up in a way that that is a tool that can be used. The funds that would be generated through property taxes from that effort are at the discretion of the county, not the developer.
Yeah, and just wanted to return briefly to the referendum campaign. You know, there has been some criticism online that they feel the referendum has kind of pitted East Side residents against West Side residents, saying they feel that Dakota Pacific's kind of targeting the East Side to gain momentum. What's your response to that?
I think we're trying to inform the broader public. They're being asked on the East Side, just as they are on the West Side, to sign something. We're trying to arm them with information that's relevant. I would argue that the majority of East County residents maybe have not been as closely tuned in to this issue over the last 5 years. And so I think there's been a disproportionate amount of information share there just to try to help bring them up to speed. But it's a countywide issue, and we're trying to make sure that all folks are fairly informed.
Yeah, and I did just, is there any point where Dakota Pacific would decide to move on and sell the property?
No, we're in it for the long haul. We believe strongly in this. We've spent tremendous effort along some very good people in the county. Look, we've been at odds with members of the county at different points of time. But I can tell you that over the course of the last year, I've gained a tremendous amount of respect, partially because of the way that they've pushed us. It's been a very difficult negotiation, very, very difficult. A lot of different concessions that had to been made that, quite frankly, we didn't necessarily want to have to make, but we think it's the right deal for the community. So we're looking at this from a long-term perspective. We understand there's many folks who are struggling with growth. They're struggling with traffic. We're trying to actually help bring solutions to that. This site will be developed. It's not going to remain de facto open space. It was decided on nearly 20 years ago to be developed. So we are pushing ahead, and we believe that we've come to a very good plan, very smart growth-oriented plan with the community, and that is our goal.
Yeah, I'm about out of time, Mark, but is there anything else you briefly want to mention?
No, again, it's really just become informed. Reach out to your elected officials. You can go to KimballJunctionMatters.com or WasatchBackFuture.com to get the perspective from our side. I have no problem with anybody talking to the other side as well. I think people need to just become informed on the true merits and limitations. It's not a perfect plan, but I think it's a really, really thoughtful, good plan, and we're very supportive of it. So I appreciate the time and the opportunity to share our perspectives.
Yeah, and we also appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dakota Pacific CEO Mark Stansworth. We'll be right back after this. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Wednesday morning. Appreciate you tuning in. We are headed towards a winter storm watch. Our meteorologist this morning said it's likely to turn into a winter storm warning. That winter storm watch is set to take effect a Thursday morning through Saturday afternoon. We're looking at between 14 to 18 inches possible in the Park City area. Travel could be very difficult at times. The conditions are expected to impact both the Thursday evening and Friday morning commutes, so be careful out there.